The recorder started. We're very lucky today to have Doreen Grunbaum to talk to us about Holocaust, her personal Holocaust reflections. We hear a lot about the Holocaust nowadays, and it's relevant because it's a weight that that is in lots of politics, but it also will help us to understand things that are going on today, some features that are going on today. So now that we've got this screen, before we get into the talk, I want to just remind people of what's coming up. In 2 weeks, we're having a regular meeting of LA Jews for Peace, and anyone who has suggestions for an agenda, please send them to me. 2 weeks beyond that, on November 1st, we're going to have a Channel 12 special. It's a 15-minute video, sort of like a 90 minutes. The English title is Settler Violence in the South Hebron Hills. And actually, I've added, and IDF violence, because the video shows a lot of IDF violence. And we saw that just a week and a half ago, when a bunch of Jewish peace activists tried to bring water to some Palestinians living there, and the settlers and the army beat them up. And then there was also last week, there was a program by settlers on to things in the South Hebron Hills. Anyway, this will help us understand it. That's 15 minutes. 2 weeks beyond that, Mark Kleinman will talk to us. If you remember back in May, there was an incident on La Cienega Boulevard that was called anti-Semitic. And the two people who were arrested in that are now being brought up on charges for a hate crime. And Mark Kleinman is their attorney, or at least temporarily their attorney. And he'll help us to understand what went on in that situation. So I'm going to stop this now. And I'm going to introduce Doreen. Doreen, you all know, is Tony's wife. And she was born in Rotterdam. And when she was just about a year old, her family was arrested by the Nazis. And she spent time in two concentration camps. And she was also part of the Lost Transport. Even though she was very young, she has remembrances that are really common to all Holocaust, is a part of the Holocaust experience, the feeling of helplessness and starvation and disease and having no control over one's destiny. That experience is shared not only by the Holocaust, of course, but by all people, victims of war. And we've seen it recently in, of course, Afghanistan, and we see it continually in Palestine. So with that introduction, I'm going to turn the floor over to Doreen, who might want to, if she wants to, can elaborate more on her history. After she's done, she's going to talk for 10 minutes or so, 15 minutes, whatever it is, and then we'll have a discussion. So Doreen, take it away.
Because I was so young, I don't know, wait a minute. I have to fix my screen. This is not working for me. Okay. I'm just seeing you, Jeff. Is that what I'm supposed to be doing? What am I supposed to be seeing?
Well, I think you'd see all 16 or 18
people. Oh, I should put this on. Okay, I know what to do.
21 people who are here.
Right, but, okay, 1 second. Okay, got it. I was almost three, when we were liberated by the Russians. And after we were liberated, we went back to Holland. I'm gonna go backwards. We went back to Holland. And I think my parents had thought to stay there. It wasn't clear. And my father went back to the firm that he had been working for. He was in the grain business, but they didn't want him back. And so, because he had sold his shares to somebody in the company, and he was not given back his part of the company. So he was pretty disgusted by that behavior. And so at that point, they decided that they would leave Holland. And we had received papers to be able to immigrate to Palestine, but his old boss, my father's old boss, found out that my father was still alive and immediately invited him to come to the United States, and he would give him a job at the firm that his old boss had started in New York. So we did come to the United States. And I'll give the little talk that I've given before, but I just wanted to let you know that my own relationship to the Holocaust was very difficult for many, many, many years. And I spent a lot of years in therapy trying to work that out. Because I was so young, I had almost no memories, and certainly no memory of life, how life was during that time. And so about 3 or 4 years ago, I was invited by a friend to give this talk at a Holocaust museum here in Los Angeles, the one that's near the Grove. And I accepted. It was to commemorate Anne Frank's birthday. And I decided I would do that. And so it was the first time that I had ever really put my thoughts together and given a talk on this subject. And so I, excuse me, I'm gonna fix my, there. I'm trying to fix my computer. Not working, okay. And so at that time I put together this talk, and the talk was a lot of information that I finally got from my parents, from my mother, excuse me. My father had died. So I put together this talk, and it was very cathartic for me. It was really more helpful to me than it probably was to anybody who heard the talk. And so I now feel, since my mother has died, she died 12 years ago, that I have the obligation to talk about this. And so that's what I'm finally doing. So I'm going to read this talk that I gave at that time, and I gave once more at the Museum of the Jewish Heritage in New York. Actually, it's on YouTube now, I guess. And I was interviewed at that time, and I think Jeff saw that talk and got the idea to ask me to talk to you guys from that. So I'm going to read you the talk. It's about 10 minutes long, and then I'll be happy to answer questions or whatever you want. I was close to 3 when my parents, my maternal grandmother, and I were liberated by Russian soldiers from what is known as the Lost Transport, one of the trains that the Germans packed with sick and dying inmates from Bergen-Belsen. I just want to say that some of this is direct quotes from my parents, and I will indicate when they are direct quotes and also when they are my actual memories. It was becoming clear to the Germans that they were going to lose the war, and they wanted to empty the camp of as many people as possible, while at the same time hoping that Allied bombs would hit the trains. While Theresienstadt was its intended destination, the Lost Transport crisscrossed Germany for 2 weeks, mostly cattle cars and a few passenger cars from mothers with small children, including my mother, my elderly grandmother, and my very sick father, until the train was stopped by the Russians on April 23rd, 1945, outside of Tirbitz, a small town in what later became East Germany. I have a memory of lying in a luggage net above my mother in that train, which is where the small children were rocked to sleep. My mother wrote many years later that the benches in the train were hard and uncomfortable and she had to watch for splinters. The windows were dirty and locked, and because people around us were unwashed, many of them sick or dying, there was a constant terrible stench. Once a day, the train stopped so dead bodies could be removed and buried if there was time. Or from time to time, the train would stop abruptly because of overhead air fights between the Germans and the Allies. Everyone would be ordered off the trains, throwing themselves on the ground and covering their heads with their food bowls. Occasionally, people would sneak off to nearby farms to steal food, sometimes coming back with potatoes or vegetables. If the train had stopped long enough, they could manage to build a small fire, enough to cook the treasures. But most people became sick after eating because they couldn't digest this kind of food anymore. So they got terrible diarrhea afterwards. My mother also told how sometimes there was fighting in the train. Starving people stole food from each other, raw turnips, sometimes a chunk of bread. But after a while, there were those who started telling stories to pass the time. Or you could hear Yiddish songs, especially when the children were being put to sleep. Maybe that's why I've always loved Yiddish music. But that's not my first memory. Still in Bergen-Belsen, probably a few weeks before that, I have a memory of being lifted to my father's top level bunk bed. Like many others in the overcrowded, filthy barracks, he had almost died from malnutrition and diarrhea. Now he was in a hospital barrack, about 80 pounds, half his normal weight, and slowly recovering, but not able to walk or to do any work. My memory is of a dark room, of sitting high on my father's top bunk bed, and then being lifted down to the floor, where I left by walking around and over dead bodies on the floor. Throughout their lives, whenever the war was mentioned, my parents and my grandmother repeated to me again and again that without me, they could never have survived Bergen-Belsen. Here's what happened. You may know that in May 1940, Rotterdam was bombed beyond recognition by the Nazis. My parents tried to escape various times, but they didn't succeed. They even discussed suicide over and over, but each time they changed their minds, thinking it would always be an option later. Over time, as Jews, their rights were restricted as more and more anti-Jewish laws were enacted. But by 1942, my mother was pregnant with me. Many of their friends were having babies, and my mother had somehow become more optimistic, thinking that the war had to be over soon. So I was 13 months old on September 29th, 1943, the night my father was awoken by a loud knock on the door. Two young Nazi soldiers and a Dutch police officer asked for my parents' and my grandmother's identity cards, and then ordered them to be ready to leave in 30 minutes. The suitcases had been prepared months before. One of the young German soldiers told my father that he had just been ordered to leave his studies and appear for army duty. He was upset about it and advised my father to bring along biscuits and condensed milk, which he did. The Dutch police officer said they wouldn't need it. My father piled the suitcases in the baby carriage while my mother held me, and with my grandmother, they walked to the police station, followed closely by three Nazis. At the police station, they recognized many of their friends among the crowd. As they stood waiting to get on the bus, my father realized that my name was not on the list. He saw that a woman was standing on the side next to the chief of police, whom he knew. She had been mistakenly arrested. She was not Jewish after all. Suddenly, he asked the chief of police if he could give her his baby to bring to his close non-Jewish friends, the Biermann family. The chief thought for a moment and then agreed. My father wrote down their address and with the baby carriage handed me over to the lady. My mother and grandmother were numb and in shock. My father, probably numb himself, spoke softly to them, trying to assure them and himself that he had made the right decision. Most of the passengers were now on the bus and it was preparing to leave. My father ran to the still open door to check on me. What he saw was a screaming baby surrounded by a dozen Nazi soldiers. He jumped off the bus, grabbed me, ran back on the bus and put me in my mother's lap. He later wrote, "That was probably the main reason that we are still alive. The Germans would have known where Doreen was because of course they knew where the lady lived. They would have taken Doreen and sent her to Auschwitz and to the gas chamber, or they would have given her to a German family to make a German child out of her. Rita, my mother, would not have had the strength to survive Westerbork or Bergen-Belsen, and neither would I probably have. Rita would have had to work instead of being able to care for the baby and would have been physically broken." That's the end of the quote. When we first arrived in Bergen-Belsen after 6 months in Westerbork in northern Holland, there were 120 people in one barrack. By the time we left, there were 500 people. When we first arrived, there was a total of 4,000 prisoners. When we left, there were 60,000. There were no gas chambers. There was a crematorium to burn the bodies of those who had died, mostly from typhoid, typhus, bitter cold, or starvation. My mother told me that from time to time, she would take me for a walk down a path with mountains of bodies piled on one side. It was normal to me. I didn't know what I was seeing. Everything was normal to me. And I was never separated from my little world. I was never away from my mother and slept in bed with her every night. My grandmother slept nearby, and I could see my father almost every day. I had friends, and we played with whatever we could find. When I finally spoke, my first word was Achtung, the German word that screamed for attention. Now returning to the lost transport, our Russian liberators in Tribitz were kind to us. And here's a quote from my mother. "The Russians allowed us to take anything we needed from the Germans, which was everything. Anybody who could walk went. That night, we slept in wonderful beds with clean white sheets, blankets, and real pillows. It was much more than the attic room we had dreamed of." That's the end of her quote. The next morning, my mother had typhus with a high fever for 3 days. My memory is that I'm standing terrified at the foot of an enormous bed as my mother is lying unconscious, eyes closed, not moving, not hearing me cry. By then, I knew what dead meant, and I thought she was dead. But after 3 weeks, my mother was better. And then my father, still weak from his earlier illnesses, became sick again with typhus this time. He was moved to the new hospital that the Russians had organized, and my mother was not allowed to visit him. They stayed in contact through smuggled notes, my father instructing my mother what to do if he didn't pull through, but he did. On July 1st, 1945, our family, my parents, my grandmother and I were on the last transport to leave Tirbitz for Leipzig, and from there to Maastricht, Holland, by ambulance because of my father's weak condition. I have one other memory that I believe happened in Maastricht. I'm left with my grandmother in a large crowd of people when suddenly I can't find her. I look all around and then make my way through the crowd, searching and crying. Finally, a kind man recognizes me, picks me up, and takes me back to my frantic grandmother. One last quote from my mother. A few days later, while Fred was still in the hospital, our dear, dear friend, Gerrit Biermann from Rotterdam, suddenly stood before me. It had been his family's address that my father had given to the woman at the police station. Gerrit had discovered we were in Maastricht and had traveled on a milk truck to find us. Here was this tall, wonderful man putting his arms around me, asking us to come and stay with them until we found a place of our own. That's the end of her quote. We did that. And I have memories of the following 2 months when we lived with the family my father had thought to send me to, but didn't. Only 5% of Dutch Jews survived the war. Our family, part of the last group to be rounded up in Holland, was among them. That's it.
Thank you very much, Doreen. That was very moving. So I guess the floor is open. If you have a question, go to Reflections on the bottom of your screen, where you should be able to click and raise your hand. So is there...
Okay. Tony raised his hand.
I didn't raise my hand. I was applauding.
Okay. I'll say a few more things, though. One of the reasons that I was so confused my whole life about my own experience was because I didn't lose either of my parents or my grandmother. In fact, we lost one person in our family, and that was my grandmother's brother. And he wasn't with us. He was in Auschwitz. But I didn't lose anybody in my immediate family. And in fact, I was a pretty secure child, even in the worst of those circumstances, because I was with my mother the whole time and my grandmother, and I could see my father all the, you know, every day. And I think my mother tried very hard to make me feel secure. And so I was in a very unusual situation. And so when we came to the United States, I can remember we lived on a block in Brooklyn where there were a few Jews and mostly it was an Irish neighborhood. And people would say to me, "You're a Holocaust survivor?" And I would say, "Well, it wasn't so bad, really. You know, I was with my, you know, it wasn't so bad." And I didn't really know what to say. I mean, the shock on their face did not compute with the feelings that I'd had, because I really didn't remember. I just knew how I felt. So reaction followed me throughout my life. And I couldn't respond to it. I didn't know how to respond to that. And so I pretty much stayed away from the Holocaust part of my life. And my mother later became a very active, much later, of course, because nobody spoke about it at the beginning, became very active as a speaker to schools and churches and whoever wanted to hear, and gave many talks that I have recordings of here. So she felt that she needed to speak about all the things she remembered, but those weren't the things that I remembered. So it was a very different experience for me.
So,
so Tony is the only person with his hands up, but let me ask a question to start with. You said, from what I gather from what you're saying, is because of your presence, the Nazis allowed you to stay in a family unit, and that's what assured the survival of your family and yourself.
Yes, because in Bergen-Belsen was divided into several different camps. And the camp that we were in, which was called the Sternlager, the star camp, was meant for people who had exchange papers. Because the German soldiers who had been captured in Europe, especially England, actually, their plan was that we would be exchanged for them. In reality, it turned out that a lot of those soldiers didn't want to come back. And so the exchange never really happened. But we were in that group of people who were in kind of a special part of Bergen-Belsen. And it was special at the beginning. Later, as you heard, it just became overcrowded and everything got much, much, much worse. But at the beginning, that was the idea of that camp. And in fact, in that part of the camp, it was the only part where you didn't have to wear uniforms. We just had to wear stars on regular clothes. So I've been reading a lot of my parents' papers, sort of preparing for this. And it's just, I didn't get a clear idea, but it seemed like my mother was able to take with her a lot of things, clothes. She had a suitcase. So clothes and probably some toys of mine even. And so I think at the beginning, it was a different, it was different than what you hear about and what you think of as Bergen-Belsen or any of the camps.
Thank you. Okay, Tony, Shaquille, Eric, and Dick have their hands up, so we'll go in that order. And so Tony, take it away.
I wanted to prompt you to something that has always interested me, which was that for many, many years, you felt like you had a unique situation. And then you discovered that there actually was an organization of childhood survivors of the Holocaust. And if you could speak to that issue and let people here know that that you were not alone in having that feeling.
Most of my life, I really felt like there was nobody who'd had my experience. I did know of a family that we were close to, a Dutch family that I'm still close to, the Melkman family, who had a son, Avraham, and they decided to put Avraham with a Christian family because they were worried about what was coming. And so when they were put on a train to Westerbork, because we were in all the same places, they were on that train with papers for their son, Avraham, even though he wasn't with them. And on the same train, there was a woman with her small son, and they were talking, and the woman was very upset because she didn't have papers for her son, and she didn't know what to do. So the Melkman family offered to take her son, to hold on to him and pretend that he was Avraham. And so when they got to Westerbork, they all got off the train, and this little boy's mother was sent to Sobibor, I believe, and died there. And so his name was Nicky, and he stayed with the Melkman family. And he was my playmate. He was one of the children that I played with. And I knew him for many years because I continued to know the Melkman family after the war and am still close to Avraham. And Nicky had a very difficult life because he lost his mother. He also lost his father. And he came, was sent after the war. He went back to Holland. His aunt asked for him. He went to live with his aunt. Then he went to live in the various children's homes, and things never worked for him. And later I knew him in Israel. And we were never able, we both knew that we had been playmates and we had been through all of this. And we always wanted to see each other, but could never talk about the war. And later he died.
Shaquille?
Yeah, thank you, Jack.
I don't think that's what Tony was asking me about, though. Okay, that's okay. It'll come up.
Later. I'll ask it later.
We have to get unmuted.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for organizing this and having Sister Doreen share this with us. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine just recalling and recanting that whole situation. Question is, I'm just wondering, you know, in different stages of your life, as you begin to fully understand the gravitas of this tragedy and atrocity, how did this impact you or change you one way or the other over the course of your life? And how did you handle that? And how did you, where did you get the energy to really deal with that?
I think because, as I said, I didn't have many memories of it, but I think that I came out of it a pretty secure child because of my parents. And my mother was a very open-minded person, and came to the United States with not having grown up in the United States. So she had very different ideas and different values than the people around us. And when we came back, my father became, not immediately, but got MS. And became quite sick when I was about 12. And so we had a woman who cleaned our house once a week, because my mother by that time had to start working. And she was African-American. And she was the person that my mother became closest to, because she was in our house. She could see how my father was deteriorating. And so I grew up seeing, it wasn't like Clara was the maid and my mother, you know, was the employer. It was like my mother and Clara were friends. And we would go to Clara's house and I don't know, my mother just had values that, you know, they were good values. So that's how we grew up. We grew up with those values, and those values took me to where I am today. Tony, I got Tony. I don't think my mother would have been too happy about my marrying a Catholic, but she would have gotten over.
Recovering Catholic, please.
Recovering Catholic, sorry.
Eric?
Well, thank you, Doreen, for sharing this very personal, very intimate story. As you suggested, there's a lot in common with other Holocaust stories, and of course, at the same time, yours is unique. You've probably had a lot of time to reflect on how different countries and political movements and social movements have used the Holocaust or have viewed the Holocaust for their own purposes. Not to oversimplify it, but let's say from the far left, there's the idea that the Holocaust was basically a question of fascism and has to be considered in the global context of the fascist advances during that period. And the Jews were a very numerous and unfortunate byproduct of fascism, Nazism, along with Roma and a lot of other Slavs and other groups. And on the far right, of course, you get the idea that, therefore, we need Israel, and Israel is the salvation of the Jewish people, and people and the whole world hates us, and we have to exercise the most militant, militaristic procedures and acts to defend ourselves, and no one likes us, and we're all alone in this world. So, I mean, that's a sketch. I mean, there are other ways one could talk about the uses of the Holocaust too. But I wonder how your thinking has evolved over the years in terms of what the Holocaust means. I mean, how we use it. How do we interpret it to influence our behavior?
I don't know about how we use it to interpret our behavior, but
I'm asking you. Yeah.
These are good things.
I do feel like I won't say there have been other Holocausts like it, because it was so huge, and it was so carefully constructed, and that I don't know if there has been anything like that. And I do think it stands out in that way, but I do also feel that there are so many other atrocities that have occurred and are occurring today, that although it stands alone, on the one hand, everything stands alone. Every other atrocity also stands alone. And if you've been a part of any of those other atrocities, it stands alone. And even though I and maybe all of you, because you've read about it and you know somebody who's been involved, who's been affected by it, and you're all watching this because of that. We have a woman who lived with us, whom some of you may know about, Minal, who came from Eritrea and was treated horribly there in the army and had to escape and lived with us for some time, and she never heard of the Holocaust. But when we hear her stories and what happened to her and people she knew, and when we read about what's going on in other parts of Africa, we know that, that other people have had horrible experiences. When I was teaching, I used to give a ride home to a Vietnamese former general from South Vietnam who had spent 12 years in prison. And of course, my sympathies had always been with the North Vietnamese. But he used to tell me stories of how it was in prison, he was a South Vietnamese general, and he was imprisoned by the North Vietnamese, and he was tortured, and he was, and it was, and I, and he had heard of the Holocaust, but he didn't know much about it. And I thought, but I didn't know anything about his situation before. I didn't, and I sympathized with the North Vietnamese, and now he's telling me about his torture. So there are others who have suffered, and I just, you know, I don't know how to answer your question exactly, Chuck Hill.
Dick.
Chuck Hill? No, it was, who asked me that question?
Eric.
Oh, it was Eric. Yes, I'm sorry. I don't know exactly how to tell you the full answer to that question. I know there is a full answer to that question, but I don't know how, you know, how we answer the right or the far left or the far right. I just think that, you know, I don't want to say why can't we all get along, but I don't know how to answer that.
Okay.
What we're seeing the Taliban starting to do in Kabul is sort of the same thing. People have no control over their lives. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, the first thing I want to do, we have two people who have iPhones with it, and they need to mute. Just about everyone else is muted, but sometimes there's noise coming from one of those iPhones. Okay, that one. That one just lit up. So that person needs to mute. Anyway, this is the question I have. I know you didn't say you've been made many trips back to Holland. How did all the survivors get together again, and how were they able to recreate Jewish life in Holland after the war? Jeff, you need to mute too.
I'm muted.
No, you're not. Okay.
I don't know. In Holland does not have a very large Jewish community now. So there's a small Jewish community in mostly Amsterdam. So most of the Dutch survivors did not return to Holland. Most of them went to Israel or to the United States or to, you know, other parts of Europe, or did not come back. Not to Europe, I'm sorry, not to most other parts of Europe, but to Australia, to New Zealand, to the United States, to some to South America. Mexico has a very large Jewish community. And Israel, of course. And I've met many Dutch survivors in Israel. So, but there is a small community of Jews in Holland. Tony and I once, when we were in Amsterdam, I think we went to a Rosh Hashanah service. There's a synagogue that we went to, and it was filled. And so I know there are some synagogues still. We also went to the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. And so, but I don't think there is a large Jewish community there. There is, but not a large one. So.
Okay, thanks.
Carol.
Hi. Yeah, whoever has that iPhone should go ahead and mute themselves. It's taking the screen over every time it's, that one. Okay, thank you. Doreen, we were curious, how did your family get those exchange papers? What was the process there? It sounds like that was the reason you survived.
Right. My father was originally German and grew up in Frankfurt. And so his mother and his sister, who was married to also, and their two children left Germany, I think in 1937, and went to Switzerland and to Italy. And then for a time they came to Holland. And one of my cousins lived with my parents at the time. And then they all gathered in Holland and their whole family, and they decided to leave Holland for the United States. And they begged my parents to come along. And my father, who by that time was very devoted to Holland, refused to leave and said, if Hitler invades Holland, I'm going to fight. And so I guess I don't remember, I don't know what my mother thought at that time, but my father didn't want to leave. And so they left from the last boat that left from Antwerp. My parents went down to Antwerp with them to see them off, and they were able to be on the last boat that left from there. And then my parents came back, and shortly after that, Holland was invaded. So they went to the United States and later to Mexico, and they were able to get the papers that my father would need, that my parents would need to emigrate to Palestine. And while we were in Vesterbork, we received those papers. So my father had those papers, and that's why we got to the part of Bergen-Belsen where we were.
Oh, so is that
answer? Thank you.
Terzer and Yossi.
Hi, I had a question about the story that you started telling at the beginning. You said that your father had to sell his shares in the firm. Was it part of the forced selling to, I thought it was usually to the Germans. So was it also to the Dutch? And then after he came back, they just said you sold it and that's it?
Yeah. the Jews were not allowed to work anymore. And so my father and the firm was, I just read about this yesterday. The firm was owned by because my father worked there, there was somebody Jewish in the firm, and therefore it was partly Jewish. So if my father left the firm, he was one of the top people in the firm. So if he left the firm, then it would no longer be Jewish. So they wanted him out of the firm, because they didn't want to be seen as Jewish. And so he decided he would leave also. He wasn't forced at that point to leave, but he decided to leave because he didn't want to be working someplace where they didn't want a Jew. So he sold his shares to I don't know who. And then when he came back after the war and he tried to get his shares back so that he would have some money, he couldn't get them back. They wouldn't give them back to him. They wouldn't sell them back to him. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's the same thing that the Germans used to do. They just, you sold your shares or you sold the company just for nothing.
And no, that wasn't the case with him though.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
I have another kind of question, because in 1973, as a reserve soldiers, I refused to serve in the occupied territories. And my lawyer, who was a Polish Jew, was herself a Holocaust survivor. And she defended me. Later on, in a private conversation, I went to her home to thank her and everything. I asked her how her Holocaust experience or what she was going through and her parents and family affected her in thinking what she has to do personally. Because she told me also that she met other survivors in Israel that took another path. And she said the whole debate, how you react, what is the lessons? And she said that from now on living in Israel, she will be on the side of the people who are oppressed.
Right.
Or somebody like me who gets sympathy to the oppressed. But she told me, Yossi, you have to understand there are some other people who have a different lesson, is the revenge lesson or hate or distrust of anybody who is not a Jew. So I wonder if you in real life and dealing with this, did you ever met in the United States or in Israel also a Holocaust survivor, and you ever had any discussions about what is your lesson from this? What you now dealing with this when you hear somebody else suffer is sympathy, or if they're not Jews, I don't care, or something. If you can give us some,
You know, this is a question that the interviewer asked me also in the interview that I did. I think that everybody really comes away with it with a different their own personal view, and I think part of that view is based on who they were before they went into the Holocaust, who they were before. Not always, and I'm sure there are people who completely turned around from that experience, but I do think it's, and I feel that I have to respect everybody's takeaway from it. I would never try to convince somebody that they were wrong and I was right in there, because their experience is their experience. And if they come away from their experience, I mean, first of all, you know, who am I talking about now? At this point, I'm 79 years old and, you know, I was 3. So most of the people I'm talking about are dead. But I really feel that I have to respect everybody's experience from that. Just as, you know, the Vietnamese general who I drove home and was telling me that the North Vietnamese tortured him. I mean, what am I gonna say to him? You know, but the North Vietnamese are, you know, they did something good for their country. I'm not gonna say that to him. Because his anger and his hurt is so profound that I would not try to, I would just tell him maybe what I feel about my own experience, but not try to change his mind. Or change his experience. He's telling me about an experience and he's responding to that, and I can't convince him of something different.
Okay, there. Well, Tony, you've got your hand up again, but I've got another question also. Doreen, the pictures we always see of Bergen-Belsen, are these people just completely starved to death? So that was sort of a, but yet your part of Bergen-Belsen didn't seem to, from what you're saying, didn't seem to have this starvation routine.
Oh, there actually, it did. I mean, as I said, my mother, towards the end of the war, there were, what did I say? There were 60,000 people in Bergen-Belsen. At the beginning, there were 4,000 people in Bergen-Belsen. So the conditions became impossible. And people did not die in the gas chambers. People died of starvation and of from sickness, from typhus, spotted typhus and typhoid. And they were, and what did they do with the bodies? They didn't put them in crematoria. They piled them up on the side of the road and they just piled them up. So it was, at the beginning, it was not what it was at the end.
Tony?
Yeah, let me refresh my original question, which is, you've met since, over the past number of years, you've met fellow child survivors of the Holocaust. And yeah. If you could speak a little bit about that and the organization, because those are people who are our age, who have survived, and the older ones, of course, who might have been 7, 8, 9, 10 at the time, have a stronger memory than you would have had.
Right. Well, there were two things. One is that when I was in my early 30s, I think, there was a journalist by the name of Helen Epstein, and she was a child of survivors. And it was really the first time that anybody had talked about a group of people, a child of survivors, and what their problems were. And she organized a conference in New York that I went to. It was a big room, big auditorium, filled with children of survivors. And so at that, and there were many people who talked about various things. And so I asked the question there, are there any people in this room who are actual child survivors? And about 7 women came up to me afterwards, and we started a kind of a group to meet. And one had been in the woods in Poland with her family, hiding. You know, they each one had been hidden in France during the whole time with her family. One had lost a parent, I don't remember exactly, but everybody had different experience. And I was looking for somebody who had had my experience. And so after a while, we stopped meeting because we realized that we didn't really have what we were looking for. This group didn't have what we were looking for. Much later, really very much later, I'd say about 3 years, I know, about 6 years ago, I was visiting my sister in Boston, and my sister had met somebody who was she kept saying to me, he was in the same place as you were, but at the time I was living here already, and I just wasn't paying attention. But I was visiting my sister, and she was on the phone. I was in the kitchen, and I heard her talking to somebody, and then she said, Doreen, come over here. There's somebody who wants to talk to you. And so suddenly I'm talking to somebody who was in Vesterbork, was in Bergen-Belsen, and is exactly my age. And I was shocked. And so he and I had breakfast the next morning in Boston, and we sat there and we talked for hours and hours about everything that was the same. He had been in the same barrack. And I don't think that we played together necessarily, I don't know. It turned out that my mother remembered his mother, and it was the most uncanny thing. It was incredible for me. And then he took me to a bookstore and he bought me a book, which I don't have here. It was written by a rabbi by the name of, I don't have it. If anybody wants to know though, later I'll let you know what this book is. And it's a book that was written by a rabbi who was in Vesterbork, was in Bergen-Belsen, was the same age as we were. And he wrote a book about his experience and his parents' experience. And so I read that book, and it was shockingly familiar. And so I suddenly felt, and then I called him and I talked to him for many hours, the rabbi who wrote this book. And we spoke on the phone many times. And I just felt like, wow, I suddenly have two people in my community. My parents, all the years I was growing up, they knew 100 Holocaust survivors, and they had this community, and we were part of this family, all of us. But I didn't have a family like that for myself. And so I was so validated by Frank Epstein, this man that my sister knew, that I think that's what liberated me to be able to start talking about what happened. Thank you, Tony, for reminding me.
Thank you. Are there more questions? If not, we will thank Doreen for sharing these experiences with us.
Susan, I think Susan has a question.
Oh, okay, Susan.
You're muted, Susan. You're muted.
No, can you hear?
I don't mean Susan. I mean Susan. Susan von Mantz.
Susan von Mantz.
Yeah.
There you go.
I just want to say, oh my God, I was just blown away by this. I'm so happy that we were able to hear this. I'm just blown away. I did have one question. I wanted to find out. So am I right in assuming that the Dutch government did very little to protect Dutch Jews when the Nazis invaded? I mean, was that just kind of over?
I think the Dutch government, I mean, the Dutch army, was forced to capitulate after something like five days after the German invasion.
Ugh.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much. I can't wait to talk with you about it more. Oh my God, it's just amazing. Thank you so much. Yeah, I just want to say I love your spontaneity, your integrity, your reality, and your willingness to share on so many different levels. It's blown me away. I love you, and I love Tony.
Are there more comments?
I did have a question. I mean, the Nazis were horrifically cruel by starving you. When you went in, you were a baby. When you came out, you were 3. So you grew. So, I mean, your mom had her clothes with, but how did you manage to be dressed and all the other little ones?
First of all, I had been sick a lot in the camp. What I read yesterday, which I've never read before, my mother kept a diary of my development.
Oh my God.
And wow. I've always seen it. I've looked through it. It's in Dutch. It's in Dutch, and it's the actual diary is in the Museum of the Jewish Experience in New York.
Whoa. Amazing.
But I found a typed copy of what was in the diary yesterday. And I'd never read it, the whole thing, before. And I read it. And I realized that I had been sick much more than I realized, than I had known. I kept having ear infections, and I had pneumonia. And my mother convinced, and there was a hospital barrack, and my mother convinced the people in the hospital barrack to let her take care of me there. And which is probably why I survived. There was a little girl next to me. Her name was Millie Blick, who my mother talks about, who was born just in the camp and then got sick and died and was with us in that room. And my mother talks about how my friends came around and looked in the window and waved at me, and how I was so happy to see them. And so clothes, I think she had packed clothes for me also. I still have a little pinafore that I wore there. Wow. And that I've always kept. And so, so my mother, I mean, we had enough food. She talks about food in the diary, what I ate, you know, potatoes and kohlrabi, but I ate things. And she talks about how today Doreen had a hearty appetite and ate all her food. And then she talks about other times, she talks about, well, Doreen has really lost a lot of weight. She's too thin now. And but then she talks about, well, Doreen gained back all her weight. So I'm not exactly sure. I can't even answer that question. I don't know where I know about the clothes. I had clothes, but I don't know where the food came. However, at the end of the war, I think food was very hard to get. So.
And we still don't eat kohlrabi very regularly.
No, but the first time, my mother never cooked it. Never. I never had kohlrabi again. Never heard of it. And then about 20 years ago, one day we were invited to somebody's house and they served kohlrabi. And I tasted this food and I couldn't believe it. It was so familiar to me. I just couldn't believe it. And I loved it.
Oh,
and,
good.
And, yes. And, you know, Tony, we've eaten kohlrabi. I love it. I still have it.
Yeah, if I can just add one little thing, I don't know if I'm muted or not.
No.
I'm blown away by your intimacy and your vulnerability and your openness, and it just blows me away. And I love being your friend.
Thank you. You should mute yourself, Susan.
Are there any other comments? Then I'd like to thank Doreen for being so open with us and sharing. And everybody's story is unique, as Doreen said, but there's also commonalities with what Doreen went through, to what many people who are caught up in political and military conflicts are go through to this very day. So it's a lesson that's not only 70 years old, but it's we're seeing these kinds of situations today. So I'd like to thank Doreen, and I thank you all for joining us.
Thanks, Doreen.
Thank you.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Shaquille.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Shaquille. See you all soon.
Hey, Shaquille, come into town so we can have lunch.
Surely. I'm going to text you or email you, and we'll plan accordingly. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Copy Cooper on it.
Right.
I know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hello, Yoshi.
Thank you, everybody. Hi, Daryl. Hi, Uncle Daryl.
Good to see you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for coming, everybody.
Yoshi is a great guy. Wow. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doreen. It was very interesting. And, you know, like your friend said, it was illuminating, you know. And
thank you, Tirza.
And yeah, it was spoken from your heart and you can feel it. And I think you are a very unique person, the way you treat the world now. So.
Okay, folks.
Till then.
Good night from the garage. Bye-bye.
Bye. Have a good night.
It's just you and me, Doreen. Thanks an awful lot. You did wonderfully.
Thank you. Thanks.
People really appreciated it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for inviting me.
Bye-bye.
Bye. How do I get out of here?
I'm ending it for all.